From the heart of The Ohio State University on the Oval, this is Voices of Excellence from the College of Arts and Sciences with your host, David Staley. Voices focuses on the innovative work being done by faculty and staff in the College of Arts and Sciences at The Ohio State University. From departments as wide-ranging as art, astronomy, chemistry and biochemistry, physics, emergent materials, mathematics, and languages, among many others, the college always has something great happening. Join us to find out what's new now.
I'm delighted to be joined today on Zoom by Skylar Cranmer, who is the Carter Phillips and Sue Henry Professor of Political Science at The Ohio State University College of the Arts and Sciences. His research focuses on network science, particularly the role of topology in modeling complex networks and forecasting their evolution, with the goal of developing network-based theories, innovative statistical methods for network analysis, and policy-relevant predictions. Welcome to Voices, Dr. Cranmer.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, so I just introduced you as someone who studies network science, and I think we should probably begin there. What's meant by network science?
So network science is, in many ways, a field of science that is interdisciplinary in nature. So network science is fundamentally, it's the study of connection. You and I are connected in that we know each other, but people have all sorts of different connections. And it's not only people who are connected to one another, but machines through the internet or particles that are interacting with each other in different ways. There's all sorts of ways in which things in nature are connected and interconnected with one another. And network science is the science of how those interconnections work. So network science has contributions from a lot of fields, including political science, which is the field from which I come. But it also takes a lot from physics, from mathematics, from biology, from ecology, you name it. So basically, all across the spectrum of sciences, there are interconnected phenomena that people study using network science techniques. And many have thought of network science as really just a collection of techniques, but it's grown into its own field. There are theories about how things interrelate to each other that seem to transcend specific topics. So certain forms of attachment, preferential attachment, or certain formations of networks tend to be very common in networks as diverse as human social networks to protein folding networks. So it's an interesting, I think, interdisciplinary field in that sense.
Are you yourself interdisciplinary? In other words, do you sort of rely on these other fields?
Very much. So my training is mostly in political science on paper, but in terms of the literature that I read, the tools that I use, much of it comes from outside of political science and the social sciences themselves. So we work hand in hand with people from other fields. I've published in venues as diverse as computer science, statistical physics, mathematics, statistics journals, as well as a bunch of social science venues.
Is that uncommon for people that work in network science, or is that just sort of the lay of the land?
That's fairly common for network scientists, yeah, to have this sort of diverse, eclectic set of applications. But to me, that's one of the reasons to be in the field. That makes it more fun.
Well, I said in my introduction that your work also leads to sort of policy relevant outcomes. And I'm particularly interested in your work in the policy arena. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my favorite example, kind of an oldie, but a goodie. So it was from 2013, I think is actually, maybe don't quote me on that, but sometime around there when the article was published. And published in a computer science proceeding. So a rather different venue for political scientists to publish in. But to give you an example of what that sort of policy relevant scholarship can look like, my former grad student and now frequent co-author, Bruce Damaris, he and I wrote a paper where we were interested in forecasting transnational terrorism sort of before the bang, so to speak. And what I mean by that is that if we approach forecasting terrorism from a statistical perspective, it's actually a pretty hard problem in that most forecasting techniques rely on what's called time series. So that's a long series of observations over time. And that tends to be the least interesting cases for forecasting terrorism, because there are only a handful of instances in the world where there's been a long sustained history of transnational terrorism between one country and another. So Israel-Palestine comes to mind. But that wouldn't be very helpful from a policy perspective to alert, for example, the Israeli government to the fact that there's a terrorism threat coming from Palestine. That, yeah, was pretty obvious. So what we wanted to do was see whether we could predict transnational terrorist ties from one country to another with target center specificity, but that had never happened before. So that have no time series behind them. And we did that using the broader network of transnational terrorist ties. So looking at the overall structures and how targets and senders connect to one another, and looking at profile similarities among both senders and recipients of transnational terrorism, could we leverage those network structures to predict transnational terrorism in this way? And the answer turned out to be strongly yes. So we can predict it with between 96 and 98% accuracy, which is not as impressive as it sounds, actually.
Because it sounds impressive to me.
So the issue, though, is that terrorism is a rare event, right? So you can do very well by predicting never terrorism, and you'll get a very high accuracy number, but it's not a useful prediction. But what makes our predictions useful, we think, is that we can predict these attacks with target sender specificity. The attacks that do occur, we assign probabilities that are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude higher than the attacks that ultimately do not occur. So we're doing well at predicting positive, not in the normative sense, but in the mathematical sense, positive events, as well as just the absence of terrorism, which is pretty easy to predict since it's rare.
Who is consuming this research, I guess? You say it has policy implications. Who's the audience?
Well, it led to a really weird interaction with the U.S. Navy.
Oh, okay.
So, I was in my office and got a cold call from some guy who explained to me that he was a captain in the Navy SEALs and wanted me to come give a talk like in 3 days, basically up in Rhode Island at a Navy base. I mean, he was very polite about it, but I didn't really get the sense that he was asking. So, I went up to Rhode Island. I gave a talk. And yeah, that was a lot of really bored looking senior naval officers, as well as a whole bunch of statisticians in the back who were sort of laid out along the wall. And they peppered me with questions about how you would implement this with data that I think are a lot more detailed than what I downloaded off the internet, which is where I got my data. And as soon as they had their answers, it was kind of like, okay, bye. And I never heard from them again.
Real world implications of your research.
Yeah.
Well, I know you've recently co-authored a book titled Inferential Network Analysis. And I'd like to hear more about this, but maybe start with a definition of inferential network analysis.
Yeah. So inferential is inferential from a statistical perspective. And what that means is in statistics, there are two ways of looking at things. At least two ways. So the most obvious might be descriptive analysis. So if we're just looking at the average of something or making a plot of how often something occurs over time or something like that, this is a descriptive analysis. In statistics, we're often more interested in inferential hypothesis testing, so deductive hypothesis testing, meaning we have some theory about how one thing causes another thing or is related to another thing, and we want to test that. So what we actually want to do is estimate something called a coefficient, which is a statistical measure of how closely these two things are related to one another. And this book is about how to do that sort of statistics. So the sort of statistics that we would use for hypothesis testing in the context of network data, which are quite different than traditional, what we would call rectangular data, where observations are not related to one another. The fact that observations in a network do relate to one another makes the performance of inferential network analysis a lot more complicated than inferential statistics absent that dependency.
What sorts of applications this work?
So all sorts of applications. Like I was saying before, basically any system where the elements of it are interconnected to one another is a potential candidate for this sort of analysis. But the easy example is social networks, human social networks, how people know one another. And in political science, this is important because it's pretty rare that we make political decisions in a vacuum. So our political decisions about whether we vote, what candidate we vote for, what sort of policies we prefer, all these things are rarely decisions that we make purely alone, but often make in consultation or collaboratively with our close friends, our families. We're influenced by messages that we receive from the media environment, from social media. So all sorts of connections come into us to influence these decisions. And looking at it as a network is really different than the traditional political science way of looking at these things as being driven primarily by individual attributes. And that's not to say that individual attributes don't matter. They do, but they matter in combination with these network contextual factors. So in a more traditional approach to studying, say, voting behavior, we would assume that nobody in our data set knows each other. They're not connected to each other in any way, which is reasonable if you're doing a survey. And so we would assume that they're not connected. And my voting behavior is informed by things like my age, my race, my educational attainment, socioeconomic status. All of these things are known to be predictors of political behavior. But what I think we're missing from that is the social context in which these decisions are made. And that's something that we aim to rectify by gathering network data and then doing inferential network analysis.
Are there policy implications of this kind of research? Or are there political parties that have become interested in this?
That's a good question. So political parties are definitely involved in using social media and sort of viral campaigning. I don't work for campaigns, so I don't personally know what they're doing. And they tend to keep that, I think, fairly close to the chest. But there's reason to believe, I think, that this is the sort of thing that campaigns do and can look at.
Well, I know that another area of research that you've engaged in is in political neuroscience, and I'm interested to hear more about this.
Yeah, so this is a fairly new stream of research for me. In collaboration with a former colleague of ours at OSU, he unfortunately just left for NYU a couple of years ago. So no longer a member of our faculty, but with Zonglin Liu, who's a neuroscientist formerly of OSU, he and I, as well as my frequent collaborator, James Wilson, who's a statistician, and a graduate student of mine, Suyang Yang, we've been looking at the extent to which we can predict political partisanship based only on brain scans rather than on the traditional sort of survey type instruments, the things I was just talking about, right? So age, education, socioeconomic status, all these things are good predictors of our partisanship. But we were interested in whether we could potentially even do better using only a brain scan. And this may sound like it's a big departure from my other work, but that's the cool thing about network science is that it's really not. Because in neuroscience, we're looking at how different regions of the brain connect to one another. So when we're making a political decision, for example, it's not just one part of our brain that's functioning. It's many parts of the brain functioning in concert. And we look at how they're connected to each other. And now this starts again to sound like a network problem of things connected to other things. And so we can bring in some of the machinery with which I'm familiar with to analyze a problem like that. And so, yeah, we were looking at whether or how well we could do based only on brain scans. And it turns out we can do surprisingly well. So we can do better with just a brain scan than we can with all of those traditional indicators at the individual level. And we do that by applying a convolutional neural network, which is a machine learning technique, a form of artificial intelligence, which sounds like a neural network of the brain, but it's not. Those have very similar names, but are actually different things. So we're using a convolutional neural network, which is a way of doing highly complex machine learning that involves a lot of layered interactions. We do that on a network, not of neurons, but of functional connectivity in the brain. And we find that we can predict better, actually, by a decent margin, predict someone's partisanship than with these traditional exogenous predictors. So that sort of speaks to the connection between biology and political behavior, which I find interesting, but there's a lot of work still to be done on that.
I was going to say, what is that connection? What is the connection between biology and political behavior?
Well, we as a discipline are just kind of figuring that out in the last decade or so. So there's been a really interesting wave of research looking at the genetic foundations of political behavior. So a lot of political behavior seems to be at least partially heritable. This, by the way, is mostly work not done by me. I have a single paper on that in collaboration with someone who's really steeped in that literature. So I would defer to him for questions about that. But yeah, so there has been now a fairly extensively documented relationship between our genetics and various forms of political behavior, and also some work on brain science, on neuroscience, and political behavior, that is much, much younger than even the genetic stuff. And the genetic stuff is already quite new. So our contribution to that was looking at the entire network. So traditionally, neuroscience studies have looked at activation of a particular region of the brain while engaged in some sort of task that should activate political decision-making, for example. And that alone is super cutting edge in political science and political neuroscience. It's foundational. The approach that we took was different, though, in that we're not just looking at one region of the brain, but we're looking at all of the regions of the brain together as an interactive network. And so that's taking a bit of a different tact on this, but we also have brain imaging data that isn't designed to be eliciting partisan responses. So we're not presenting the subjects with stimuli that should activate partisanship. So some of these scans are even just resting state, where someone's just chilling out in an MRI machine. And we can still see the signature of partisanship in their brain. But what's really interesting to me and remains unknown even after our study is the direction of causality there. So it's not clear if our brains look like this because of our partisanship, or if we select our partisanship because our brains look like this. And to figure out the direction of causality there, one would need longitudinal data going back to childhood, which unfortunately we don't have. So that,
because we don't have the scans, we don't have the brain scans.
No, we don't. That would be a big multi-decade study that I would love to see performed, but no one's done that yet. So that's, in my opinion, one of the big open questions in this area now, is how does that causality flow?
Did you know that 23 programs in the Ohio State University College of Arts and Sciences are nationally ranked as top 25 programs, with more than 10 of them in the top 10? That's why we say the College of Arts and Sciences is the intellectual and academic core of the Ohio State University. Learn more about the college at artsandsciences.osu.edu.
So, and I understand it's early days in this research, but presumably there would be all kinds of political parties that would be interested in this sort of data, this sort of research, this sort of approach, yes?
Maybe. It depends, right? So if that's a good question, because I hadn't really thought about it that way before. And now that I do think about it, I'm not sure that would be so interesting to them, because if it is the case that we choose our partisanship based on the way our brain networks look, then there's not much a party can do to affect that. You know, there's not much that they can do to recruit you to their side if you're coming to their side because of how your brain looks. If it's going the other way and your brain looks that way because of the partisanship that you adopt, then from a party perspective, I'm not sure it would matter. So you're already in the fold.
I don't know if I should be comforted by that conclusion or not. Those are really interesting observations.
Well, the paper is still under review, so take it with a big grain of salt.
Okay.
So yeah, it hasn't been fully through the peer review process yet.
But you said this was new research for you, and I get the impression this must be new in political science as well, pretty cutting edge.
There are only a handful of people working on this sort of thing in poli-sci, yeah. I'm not the first, but it's a small group.
I've introduced you as the Carter Phillips and Sue Henry Professor of Political Science. I'm curious to know who Carter Phillips and Sue Henry are and why they've endowed a chair.
Well, they are very generous donors to the university. Carter Phillips is an alum of the department. He did his bachelor's degree in poli-sci in our department in the 1970s and has since gone on to be, I'm not exactly sure how you would quantify it, but in my opinion, probably one of the most successful lawyers in history. And the reason why I would say that and feel like I can say that with some quantitative certainty is that he's argued the most cases before the Supreme Court of any lawyer by a pretty wide margin, actually. A very interesting guy. He's really active in the university, both in terms of fundraising for the university, but also in terms of engagement with students. So he's routinely around the university, COVID notwithstanding, but normally he's around the university quite a lot, talking to students, giving talks both in our department and in the law school, and helping OSU move its mission forward. I don't think they picked me specifically, but the department picked me with the funding that Carter and Sue provided, and I'm very grateful for it. It's really helped move my research agenda forward in a lot of different ways. So the nice thing about having an endowed position like that is that there is then a pot of money that we can use for very quick exploratory research where we might need to move fast, don't have time to get grants, or it becomes a seed project that then leads to grant-funded projects, because the grant funding cycle takes a long time to write, to apply, to wait, and all of that.
Indeed.
Before something gets funded. But sometimes time is of the essence. This sort of funding can allow us to put something together on pretty short notice and start moving forward with a research program. And one example of how that's really helped has been during COVID. In the early days of the COVID pandemic, it became clear that we were witnessing something at least pseudo-historic, in that we were able to see an issue become politicized in the Congress in real time and recorded in social media, actually. And so students in my lab and I engaged in a data collection effort. We scraped the Twitter feeds of legislators in Congress slightly before COVID became a thing, till we sent the paper in for review, which was like March of 2020. We got the early days of the pandemic captured in social media, and we applied a number of text as data and machine learning techniques to these data that we collected, and were able to track the extent to which the issue was politicized, how quickly it politicized, and what the effects of that were. So in other words, how it politicized, what dimensions different parties seized upon as they moved farther and farther apart. Because initially, it wasn't clear that this had to be a political problem, right? It was a public health crisis for sure, but it became politicized very, very quickly. And so we wrote a paper about how quickly that happened and how it happened. And that paper was published in Science Advances last year. And that's just one example of the sort of thing that we were able to do very, very quickly because of funding from private donors like Carter Phillips and Sue Henry.
So we always ask guests to fill out a short survey, help seed questions. So one of the questions we ask is, what are some of the most surprising results you've encountered in your research? Your response was fascinating. You said that how you look at a problem does much to inform your approach to it. And I'd like you to explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I'll do that in the context of an example, and one that was motivating in my early career. So as a grad student, actually something that helped get me into methodology as a field of research, which is not usual for political scientists. What was interesting to me when I was in graduate school and was learning the basics of international relations, which was my focus substantive field, and also learning the basics of statistical methodology at the same time, was the fact that there was a very strong relationship between what we could do and what we were doing, rather than what we wanted to do and what we were doing. That's what I mean when I say that how we look at a problem informs how we approach it. So in the context of international relations, the field has historically, and by that I mean since the approximate late 70s, early 80s, there's been a major focus on dyadic analysis. And by dyadic, I mean a pair of countries. So the relations between a pair of countries, so between two countries. And that's a pretty reasonable way to look at international relations, because it is the relations between countries. But from a statistical perspective, this is actually very problematic because it means that we're treating these pairs of countries in isolation. So earlier we were talking about how traditional statistical methods assume that the units are not related to each other, that they don't know each other and they don't influence each other. But in international relations, this is crazy. So all countries know that other countries exist. They're related to each other in multiple ways, with trade relationships, treaties, you name it, right? We can come up with a whole long list of how countries are related to one another. It's weird to think that a pair of countries would decide their relations in complete isolation from other pairs of countries and everything else that's going on in the world. And yet this has been a tacit assumption in the way we've analyzed data historically. So using traditional statistical techniques called logistic regression, if anyone out there knows statistics, that's been the traditional way of analyzing these data. But it assumes, again, this lack of connection among countries. And if we put that in substantive terms, it doesn't make any sense, right? This is assuming that the British declaration of war on Germany in 1939 was entirely unrelated to Germany's invasion of Poland, right? Conditional on regime type and GDP, right? Which no one would believe.
Yeah, that would be absurd to an historian.
That would be absurd to anybody, right? So no one would stand up at a conference and say that. You'd get laughed out of the room. A grad student of mine and I did sort of a historical analysis of the poli-sci literature and found well over 700 published articles that are actually making this claim because Wow. They're using this type of statistical analysis on this type of data. That's not to cast blame upon the people who have done that because there weren't better alternatives, but that's what motivated me to start looking for better alternatives and drove me in the direction of methodology and inferential network analysis. So tools where we can analyze the relationships between countries without having to make assumptions about independence in this way. That's what I mean when I say that how we look at a problem informs how we approach it. Because to give you one example of the implications of that sort of research, the major finding of international relations since the 80s, anyways, has been something called the democratic peace, which is that democracies tend not to fight one another. Depending on how you measure fight, it's either extremely rare or it never happens. So there's some minor arguments about what exactly war means and whatever, right? So it's at least extremely rare that democracies fight one another. That led to the question of why. And there's a major stream of literature that has examined why democracies tend not to fight one another. And there are theories about institutional checks and balances that make it harder to engage in wars, especially aggressive wars. There are theories about how we develop concepts of enmity, and it's harder to see a fellow democracy as being a hostile power, and so on and so forth. And all of these theories, or at least most of them, are about what pulls democracies together. But if we look at it from a network perspective, it actually becomes stupidly simple, which is that democracies have common enemies. And countries with common enemies don't fight each other. That wouldn't make any sense for two countries at war with a third to be at war with each other. And so when we control for this network structure within a triad, which is something you can't do in these traditional statistical techniques, then the attractive power of democracy to democracy goes away from a statistical perspective. And the answer becomes much simpler and then also more complicated. So yes, it's simple to say that countries who have common enemies don't fight each other. The question then becomes, well, why do democracies have common enemies? Then the question becomes about enmity formation rather than what is peaceably attracting democracies. But my perspective is that we've been led sort of in the wrong theoretical direction for decades, because we were looking at it strictly as pairs of states, rather than as a complex, evolving, interconnected network. So that's a very long-winded answer to a simple question of why. What do I mean when I say that how we look at a problem affects how we approach it? That's what I mean.
Tell us what's next for your research.
So what's next for my research is what I think is an exciting new stream of research that combines my expertise in network analysis with things that are comparatively new to me and also comparatively new to the field, which is machine learning and computational linguistics. So machine learning I've been working on for a little while now. In academic terms, that's several years. And computational linguistics is relatively newer to me personally. But my team and I, which is an interdisciplinary team from a couple of universities, as well as a lot of students in my lab here at OSU, we have been collecting data on everything that's been said on the news since the 1970s, and have complete text transcripts of everything that's been said on the news since the 70s. And so we're applying computational linguistics tools to understand the nature of that dialogue, but combining that also with machine learning techniques for prediction and network science techniques for looking at who's connected to whom and how information is moving about within the media landscape. And so this is a big project that I assume will produce many, many papers over the coming years. We've only got a couple out for review right now. It's early days, but so far it's been interesting stuff. One paper that we have under review right now, for example, looks just descriptively at who's used to communicate partisan information. The idea was that if news organizations were perhaps nefarious, they might use messengers for certain messages that they didn't want their base to resonate with, who would be less relatable to their base. So, for example, big literature on perception, partisan perception, shows that white men, especially older white men, tend to be viewed as more conservative. People of color and women tend to be viewed as more liberal. And so if you wanted to represent the out party in a way that would make a partisan base reject their message or more likely to reject their message, then you would prefer to have that point of view represented by someone who would be perceived as more extreme. And so it's perhaps not surprising that we find that MSNBC tends to represent conservative opinions with white men, and Fox News tends to represent liberal opinions with women of color, statistically disproportionately so, which I think is interesting. It suggests the possibility of some implicit priming there.
Skylar Cranmer, thank you.
Thank you.
Voices from the Arts and Sciences is produced and recorded at the Ohio State University College of Arts and Sciences Technology Services Studio. Sound engineering by Paul Kotheimer, produced by Doug Dangler. I'm Ava Dale.